The following presentation was recorded live by HAudio.com.
Okay, so guys, we left off with this concept that the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children. Okay, that which happens in early Jewish history is the revealed pattern for everything that comes later. And we ran through our introduction about the purpose of creation, relationship with God, and humanity blows it, and along comes Abraham and chooses for himself and for us this unique responsibility. Humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. And we talked about the time frame, 6,000 years. What I want to do now is actually work our way through early Jewish history, just going through the major events. This isn't a Bible class. This is a huge amount of discussion we can have on all these topics. What I want to do is work our way through the events so we can begin to understand how we should be learning these stories as a guidebook. And that's what the Bible is, the written text of the Torah. It's not a legal document. We don't learn Jewish law from it. It's not a book of Jewish history. It's not a book of Jewish culture. If it was a culture book, it would certainly have the recipe for chicken soup in it. Rather, it's sort of our basic hashkafa. It's our software operating package. And we have to learn how to read the text correctly so we learn the correct lessons. We really have to start thinking with Jewish software. And one of the best ways to do this is to begin in the book of Genesis and go through some of the big patterns, the stories, the themes. Now, God is an excellent educator, by the way. He doesn't waste time filling our heads with things we don't need to know. He likes to keep it nice and short and sweet. Okay. So if we begin with at the beginning of the Bible, actually the third Torah portion of Genesis, if the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children, and we also talked previously about this concept that these original nations and the people who founded those nations pass on to their descendants, not just physical genetic characteristics, but soul traits. So we Jews are children of Abraham and Sarah. We have a personality, that we, as we talked about before, that comes from those people. So it's absolutely critical for us to understand Abraham especially. And since the Bible is a guidebook and only deals with the basic information we need to know, most important information, then that which is first said about Abraham is critical for us to understand who we are as Jews. So if we go to Genesis, to Lech Lecha, third Torah portion in Genesis, where Abraham first appears, first we have an interesting question. I mean, in the first couple sentences, we're going to see with the biggest brushstrokes some very important patterns in Jewish history. If we begin at the beginning of Lech Lecha, it says the famous quote, God says to Abraham, Ve'omer Hashem al Avraham, Lech Lecha me'artzecha mimolatetecha mibet avicha. Now, God, unlike Dickens, you know, Dickens got paid by the word, so he liked to make things long. God likes to keep it short. God says to Abraham, go from your land, from your hometown, from your father's house. Why did he repeat the language three times? What's the point? Just say leave once. Leave Iraq. Or leave Turkey. Sorry?
He's even more specific.
Yeah, he's moving from, what's your closest? You know, you live in America, you move to Israel, but what's your closest emotional connection? To, you know, the United States, to Kennedy Airport or to, you know... Your home. God's telling Abraham, meaning God is telling us, the Jewish people, separate yourself completely. Take out the word Abraham, put in the word Jew, and in the first couple sentences in this parsha, you see some of the biggest brushstrokes, some hugely important lessons. He's saying to Abraham, meaning to us, separate yourself completely. We're going to be a unique nation. As Bilam, the non-Jewish prophet, says in the Hebrew Bible, Am Shishkan Levado, a nation that dwells alone and is not reckoned amongst the nations. Abraham is called Avraham HaIvri. You guys know what Ivri means? He lived on one side of the river. It didn't mean he lived in New York and everyone else lived in New Jersey. From Abraham onward, we Jews are going to be in a different place than the rest of the world. Different place. Separate. We already talked about that double standard. The standard for the Jew and the standard for everyone else. Jew and Gentile, how we divide the world up. So a unique nation, unlike anyone else in the world. He then says, go to the land, I'll show you. What's the land he shows us? I know we think Brooklyn is the promised land, some of us, but it isn't. It's Israel. Now the land of Israel is not a piece of real estate given by God to the Jewish people, to Abraham, as a payoff. We have to appreciate the land of Israel as a unique piece of real estate, the only place in the world we can actualize our potential. I'll give you an example. I travel around the world doing presentations, PowerPoint presentations. I have a laptop and a computer, and I've noticed the hard way that every country in the world has a different wall outlet. The wall outlet in South Africa is not the same wall outlet as in Australia, as in America, as in Canada. I have like a Plugs of the World collection. We, the Jewish people, are unique appliance. The only place we plug into is the land of Israel, which means we'll be bounced from place to place until eventually we end up back here.
What do we learn from that? Buy real estate now. You know, Messiah could be on the way, and you're going to be competing with 5.2 million American Jews trying to buy in the German colony.
Okay, so we're going to have this unique homeland. So we see idea number one, unique nation. Okay, separate from the rest of the world. Unique homeland, Israel. Then God says, I'll make you into a great nation, because God is actively involved in our history. Stuff happens to us that doesn't happen to anyone else. Jewish history is really unique. For those guys who have seen, you guys done Discovery? You've seen the seven wonders of Jewish history? Which is why when Louis XIV, the king of France in the 17th century, asks Blaise Pascal for proof of the supernatural, what does Pascal answer? The Jewish people, your majesty. Because God is actively involved in our history. Stuff happens to us that doesn't happen to anyone else. We literally violate all the laws of history. So unique history. Then God says, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. What does that mean? Pretty straightforward. People who are good to us will do well, and people who are bad to us will suffer. So I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Simply put, people that are good to us will do well, and people that are bad to us will suffer. And by the way, the weirdest aspect of all of this is that the nations that are often the best to us are often the nations that are the worst to us. Ironically, most of the greatest explosions of anti-Semitism take place in places where we Jews are seemingly most accepted, most liked. Where does it begin first? We'll see, in Egypt 3,500 years ago. But where else? Jews in Spain before the expulsion, 1492. Jews in Poland before the Chmelnytsky massacre, 1648, 1649. What's the best example of this? Germany. Seemingly the best relationship, Jews and Germans, and boom. Nations that are good to us will do well. Nations that are bad to us suffer. You can literally chart the rise and fall of civilizations, nations, and empires by how they treat the Jewish people. And again, like I said, some of them, they're good, they're bad, up and down. Interesting pattern. Very interesting pattern in history. And last but not least, we have this idea that through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. Through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. Which means what? We're going to have a unique impact on the world. Unique impact on the world. I don't know if you guys have seen my book, World Perfect, or seen the seminar, Jewish Impact on Civilization. We, the teeny tiny Jewish people, have arguably had the greatest impact in human history, greater than the greatest civilizations and nations and empires. We introduced to the world the idea of one God, absolute morality. We've totally transformed the world. But what's the point? In the first couple sentences in Lech Lecha, where Abraham, the proto-Jew, is introduced to us, the grandfather of all of us, we get with the broadest brushstrokes some of the key patterns of what being Jewish is all about. A nation that dwells alone and not reckoned amongst the nation. A unique homeland where we can actualize our potential. A history that's unlike anyone else's. This wild relationship with the non-Jews. I mean, really strange. It's they can't live with us, they can't live without us. The greatest love-hate relationship in history, anti-Semitism. And last but not least, we have this incredible impact on the world, even though we shouldn't even be here. Okay, so that's the sort of introduction. But what we want to do now is work our way through some of the early narrative in the Bible. Some of the early stories. Now, again, this is not a Bible class. We could spend hours and hours going through this, but just to run through the basic plot, and we can learn some very interesting lessons from the actions of our earliest forefathers. So we said Abraham, over 3,700 years ago, he's married to Sarah. What's their relationship, by the way, besides husband and wife? Anyone know? It's uncle and niece. They're not biologically related in that case, but uncle and niece. Okay? Abraham is told he's going to be a father to many nations. But what's the problem? They have a specific problem they have to deal with. What's the problem? Anyone know? Sarah's barren. We're told she doesn't even have a uterus. There's no way she's going to have kids. So what does Sarah do to rectify that problem? Who knows the story? She gives Abraham another wife. Who's the other wife? Hagar, right. Hagar. Hagar is not some cleaning lady. Hagar is the daughter of Pharaoh, one of the gifts. In the Middle East, you get interesting gifts. Please, take a daughter, you know. And one of the gifts that Pharaoh gives Abraham is a daughter. She's a very righteous woman, by the way. But she doesn't have the problem that Sarah has. She gets pregnant right away and gives birth to whom?
Ishmael.
Okay. Now, God tells Abraham, you're still going to have offspring through Sarah. It's going to be supernatural. Ishmael is not going to carry on the mission. He's not going to be the Jewish people, but he's a descendant of Abraham.
He has some of the spiritual greatness of that relationship. He's given a blessing by Abraham. He's told he's going to be a great nation. And sure enough, we see, by the way, who comes out of Ishmael? Who are his descendants, guys? Right. First of all, the Arabs, which is definitely a huge force in history. They hold that as their independent tradition also. And also, out of Judaism, historically, will come two offshoot religions. What are the two offshoot religions that come out of Judaism? Islam and Christianity. Now, Christianity actually comes before Islam. But Islam, today, 70% of the Muslims in the world are not Arabs. But Islam begins as a religion of the Arabic-speaking peoples of the Arabian Peninsula 1,300 years ago. So all this little off of this little side, you know, story here of Hagar to Ishmael comes a great nation and a great spiritual force. By the way, if what's said about Abraham is a mini version of what he's about, what we already looked at, what's said about Ishmael is going to be a mini version of what his descendants are about. What's the famous quote about Ishmael? He will be a pere odom, a wild ass amongst men. He's talking about the Judean wild ass, an animal with a serious attitude problem. Interesting. And it says, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone will be against him. Fascinating. There's a lot of different commentators. What does that mean? That he will be in like conflict with other people, which, by the way, largely you see in the world today. The Arab-Islamic world, most of the conflicts in the world, 75% plus, have to do with Muslims or Arabs fighting amongst themselves or other people. Interesting. His hand will be against everyone, everyone will be against him. A more interesting comment is a rabbinic statement that he will need everyone and everyone will need him. What's that talking about? He will need everyone and everyone will need him. What does everyone need him for?
Oil.
By the way, the Arab-Islamic world doesn't really produce anything besides those countries that have oil. That's their total source of income. They need everyone else for everything else because they're not industrialized. By the way, there's no real industrialized Middle Eastern Arab state of the 22 states of the Arab League. And everyone needs them for their oil, which, by the way, arguably is a big curse for them because it's kept them dependent on one thing and kept them from developing truly free market industrialized economies and et cetera. Yeah?
That Isaac, when he gave the blessing to his son, was that he was going to have great materialistic treasure while Yaakov was going to get the...
You're getting a little ahead of us. You're getting that's we're talking specifically about the blessing of Jacob and Esau, which is the next. We're going to get to that in a bit. But yeah,
two questions. One was: do Muslims see Hagar as Sarah as the? Do they see it in the same way that you portrayed it, with Hagar being a kind of extra?
No. Muslims change the story after. We'll save that for the class on Islam. The Islamic take is that the whole binding of Isaac story was the binding of Ishmael story. They have a holiday even, Id al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice, where God takes Ishmael to sacrifice him. They just changed the plot after, and no one sued them for plagiarism or changing the plot, but that's a separate problem.
And secondly, it sounds like God wanted Ishmael to go ahead and have this nation that was troublesome.
Okay, you're getting to a very complicated topic about what in the grand scheme of things is the place of Islam or Christianity in the big master plan. And if actually we'll hold on in a couple classes, when we get to the whole notion of Islam, we talk about it as a separate class, and Christianity, we'll talk about that, if you don't mind not doing it right now. But it's a very interesting point, because everything's part of the plan, one way or another. Did it have to happen that way? Not necessarily, like we saw in the first class. We have different paths we can take. We decide the path we take. There's the hard way, the easy way. Alternative offshoot religions are not the ideal from the Jewish perspective, but we'll save that for when we finish the two classes on Islam and Christianity. Yeah?
How do the two concepts coexist, where you just said, you know, what is said of Abraham will be said of his children, and then what is said of, you know, Hagar's son, and then Hagar's and all the descendants of Ishmael will be, you know, said of his children, at the same time as just saying that we have a choice? Ishmael's children, what the same things can be said of them?
No, because Ishmael is, that's odd. There's an interesting point. Ishmael is not Jewish. Why not? Because his mother's not Sarah. He's not Sarah. What makes you Jewish is what? Judaism is quite unique this way. Other religions, it's the father. It's the mother makes you Jewish. Why? Judaism teaches, this is a whole class on gender, but Judaism teaches that you get different aspects of your soul, your spirituality, your personality, not biological aspects, from father and mother. The male, not just Jewish, the male represents the external. aggression is a universal trait in all male mammals, by the way. The male is the external. So Hagar is not... All the men, Abraham, Isaac, they all marry women from one family. To make great Jews, you got to have the father and the mother. Otherwise, you just get someone who's got part of the stuff, like Ishmael does, but he's not Jewish. The woman represents the internal, the pnimiut. Think about it. Even in reproduction, the man is the external. Think about it. A man, you know, deposits a seed in a woman. It's a quick action. And she spends 9 months making it into a baby. And it still looks like the father anyway. The very essence of who you are comes from the mother. It's a spiritual reality. Okay, that's how it works. Yeah.
What about, for example, Moses and King David and Solomon? They sometimes had wives.
All of them did. Everyone. Every single person in the Bible, in the beginning of the Bible, marries someone. There's no, first of all, hey, at this point, there's no...
Their children are Jewish.
How come? Is Abraham Jewish? Every one of the women they marry joins the Jewish people. Abraham is a Jew by choice, and every woman who joins after that. Anyone can become Jewish. Anyone can become Jewish. They're not. Hagar is not. She's not holding where Sarah is. Sarah has her thrown out of the house, as a matter of fact.
Why wasn't Hagar Jewish?
I just can't go. No, I'm not trying to cut you off. It's a great question, but we could spend a whole thing talking about Hagar and a relationship, and we don't really have, this isn't the forum for it. But to make great Jews, you need the internal spiritual energy of these specific family of women from what is today Turkey, combined with the male energy of Abraham. Then you get the Jewish people. So he has some of the traits, Ishmael, but he's not Jewish. Okay? Like a lot of people in the world today. Yeah.
I don't really understand how that refutes my question. Are you saying that non-Jewish people don't have free choice?
Everyone has free choice.
Exactly. So, and it does this idea of the father's story continues into his children not follow into non-Jewish people either?
I'm not following your question.
Okay, so you said that
the
what is said of the father will be reflected in the children. And then you said because Hagar was not Jewish, it doesn't matter with Ishmael. Right? So
meaning he has partial, because you get traits from both parents. He has some of the traits that come from Abraham, but he doesn't have the Jewish soul, which only comes from the mother.
I guess my question is every, like, where is the line between Ishmael's descendants are doomed to this fate?
No one. First of all, it's a great question. No one's doomed to any fate. Anyone can become a Jew. Okay, you can convert. You were actually, I don't think you were in the previous class, right? You were not in the last class I taught last week, or was it, I think it was last week, I don't know what day of the week it is anymore. But we talked about spiritual genetics, which I just don't want to go back and repeat the whole thing. I have a whole presentation on it. But no one is locked by their, you have a certain propensity to be a certain way based on who your ancestors were, but no one is locked into that. Everyone has free will. But I'm saying if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish no matter what. You cannot opt out of that. You can get baptized 1,000 times. You'll get very wet, but you'll always be Jewish. Anyone can join the Jewish people. Adolf Hitler, if he had decided in the middle of the Holocaust, that's it, I'm wrong, he would have had a lot of punishment in the next world and whatever. But even he, you can convert. No one, even our arch enemies, can convert to Judaism. That's not the same. Everyone has free will. The question is, what's your basic software operating package? And that comes from, we say, Abraham and Sarah. So we're going to have to nuke this whole recording now because it's Tzvi. Because it's just, we had so many questions, it's going to, so. Sorry, I was trying to record something for a history series, and we had all these questions in the middle, and I could see it took out too much time, so we're going to have to redo that different time. You can still record it anyway. Okay, so, if you want to talk a little more, I'll be happy to explain what I said in the previous class. I just don't want to go back and do it all over again now. So this is sort of an offshoot over here. We have a great nation, which has a great physical, political impact in the world, and a great spiritual impact, but not the Jewish people. Supernaturally, when Sarah is 91 years old, this is exactly the statement that was made previously in the beginning of Lech Lecha, when God says, I'll make you into a great nation. Sarah should never have had children. There never should have been a Jewish people. We should have been born and died with Abraham. That would have been it. But like I said, we violate all the laws of human history. At 91 years old, she gives birth to whom? Isaac. Okay, Isaac, yeah, exactly. She laughs when she hears she's going to get pregnant. I'm going to get pregnant. 90-year-old woman going to have a baby. Forget it. No way. So Isaac is married to whom? Rebecca. Okay, same family. You need that internal spiritual power of the women to make Jews. Okay? Now, Isaac repeats much of the life of Abraham. Very similar. And we're going to see that Isaac also, his wife has trouble giving birth. That's an interesting story we'll get to in a second.
Where
but I want to do...
It's
all the same family. All the same family.
How is she related to Sarah?
They're all. It's one generation. All these women are basically one generation later in the same family. He went back. He sent him back. Abraham said, don't marry from the Canaanite girls in town. Bad news. These are not good women. Go back to go back to Iraq or back to, it's a Harante. It's actually southern Turkey. Go back there and find a woman there because that's where they have good, not good breeding stock physically, but good spiritual breeding stock is this family. These women have something about them that makes them great. We want to make sure my sons marry in, back into that same family. Okay. Isaac is an interesting story. Isaac goes to live with the Philistines, not the Goldsteins, the Philistines, who were a seafaring people who actually come from Crete, Mycenae, you know, the area of the Aegean, and settle on the coast of Israel. They're talked about a lot more later in the Bible, in the book of Judges, and up to King David's time. But the Philistines are living on the coast, and it's amazing. This relationship between Isaac and the Philistines is the model, speaking about patterns, for anti-Semitism. Remember, God says, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. So here you see the great love-hate relationship. In this story here, it'll be repeated hundreds of times throughout history. Isaac lives with the Philistines. Jews move into a non-Jewish part of town. Okay? Any country where the non-Jews allow the Jews basically to do their thing is always great symbiotic advantageous relationship. What's symbiotic versus parasitic? Mutually beneficial versus parasite. Meaning the Philistine economy is doing great. The goats are giving birth, the crops are growing, the rain is coming, the trees are... Everything's wonderful. The stock market's going through the roof, the currency's strong, you name it. And then, classic pattern, for no apparent reason, what happens? The Philistines say, you know, these Jews, they're dangerous. Got to get rid of them. They push them away. As a matter of fact, the specific description in the Bible is Abraham had lived previously with the Philistines. Isaac does a similar thing. Abraham had dug wells. And it says the Philistine shepherds plugged up the wells that Abraham had dug. Now, what's the most valuable commodity on the planet Earth?
Water.
What should they have done? What should they have done, the Philistines? They should have taken the wells, not plugged them up. You ever heard of the expression, cutting off your nose to spite your face? That people do things that are bad for... To get someone else to do something that's bad for themselves. To hurt themselves to get someone else. Here's a classic example. The most valuable commodity in the world is water, especially in the Middle East. How long can you live without water? 3 days. Without food, a lot longer. Okay, unless you're a cockroach. Cockroach can go for like 7 days without eating until it starves to death. With no head. Excuse me. Imagine like living with no head for 7 days. I think I know some politicians have been doing it for longer. But anyway. So Isaac said that the Philistines plug up the wells. And they basically push Isaac's shepherds move further and further away. Until eventually when they get further enough away, the Philistines stop persecuting them. This is a classic pattern. I'll tell you where my family's from, Spire in Germany, 11th century. The Bishop of Spire, Bishop Rothard, said, wishing to make Spire into a city, I invited in the Jews. He didn't invite in. He didn't bring in 100,000. And they brought in probably a few hundred Jews into the city because in medieval Europe, if you wanted to have commerce in your city, you needed Jews. We're the great catalyst for everything. He wanted to build a cathedral. But jump ahead several hundred years and you see that in Spire, going to the 15th century, the Jews are expelled and invited back in 3 times in 100 years. In Mainz, on the Rhine, not far from Spire, the Jews in the same century are invited and expelled 5 times. Probably by the second or third time, they said, you know what? We're not even going to unpack. We're going to live out of our suitcases. Like, what's going on there? Why would they expel us? Because for some reason they accuse us of being negative or bad, which we're not. We leave. What happens to their economy? The Philistine economy. When Isaac leaves, so then they invite us back in. Then they throw us out. Invite us back in. Throw us out. They can't live with us. They can't live without us. It's the greatest love-hate relationship in history. Sorry?
5 times, and what was the span of time?
In Mainz, 5 times in 100 years. It's unbelievable.
Why did the Jews keep coming back?
Well, because we usually have no choice. We have to go wherever someone's going to let us live. Okay? Sometimes we think it's going to be better. We never learn. That's a problem. We're stiff-necked, like we saw before. You'd think Jews would know by now that no place in diaspora is ultimately safe if that wasn't proven infinitely, huge number of times in human history. Well, we don't get the lesson. We think this will be different. We fool ourselves. But it's unbelievable. Can't live with us. Can't live without us. Go back to the narrative.
Abimelech, when the Jews are thrown out, Isaac leaves with the shepherds, the Philistine economy collapses. Then Abimelech and his general Pichol come after Isaac, and they find him. He's way far away. And they go, ah, I see we only prospered because of you. Now make a treaty with us. Promise us to be nice to us. And Isaac's probably thinking, like, what are you smoking? Like, what did I ever do to you? But this is exactly, it sounds weird you read the story, but I can show you over and over again in history. This is one of the great patterns. This is the pattern for anti-Semitism. Accusing Jews of being disloyal or dangerous when we're not. Throwing us out, inviting us back in, and so forth. Okay, Rebecca has an extremely difficult pregnancy. Every generation, this is the pattern. We should never have come into existence. We never should have survived. After a very difficult pregnancy, she gives birth to twins. What are the twins' names? Esau comes out first, and Jacob. Now, these guys are very different. They're fraternal twins, and personality-wise, I have identical twin daughters, Sarah and Adina. They're very cute. One gives the other one a dress and says, put this on, I want to see what I look like. You know, but they're also a very different personality. These guys are as different as you can get. Esav is born like fully ready to go. He comes out with a beard, you know, shotgun, you know, mud flaps, pickup truck. He's a total doing guy. He's also incredibly sharp, smart. He's the great-grandfather of all lawyers. He's called Tzayed Bepiv. He hunts with his mouth, which means he's the great-great-grandfather of all politicians, because we know that a lawyer is just a larval form of politician. Okay. But he's an incredibly deceptive person, by the way. Hunts with his mouth. Jacob is Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He's the pure one. Simple not meaning stupid, simple meaning very straight. He likes to sit in the room and to read the books and probably not a lot of physical exercise, you know, not much of a tan. And it says, by the way, interesting, it says that Isaac favors Esav and Rebekah favored Jacob. What's going on here? Now Hirsch, Samson Raphael Hirsch, the great German Jewish Bible commentator from the 19th century, he adds an interesting point here. He says that Isaac knows that someone's got to carry on the mantle of leadership to create the Jewish people. Esav is the logical choice for two reasons. A, he's the firstborn. He's first out of the womb. Okay. And B, he seems to be the doer. And to change the world, you got to be a doer. But also we see that Isaac is somewhat deceived by Esav, who's a very deceptive person. One of the great lessons you see in the Bible, and you can see I'm not saying this because, you know, there's women in the room. There's no women in the room here. But in all these different stories, you see the women see things the men don't. And the men are on an incredibly high level here. Abraham, Isaac, these are prophets. But women in general, we see things that men don't see. You know, they had that joke. How do you know Abraham was Sephardi? God had to tell him to listen to his wife. And every Ashkenazi man knows, you know, that joke. You know, I knew I married Mrs. Wright. I just didn't know her first name was Always. So, now, seriously, Sarah tells Abraham, you have to get Hagar and Ishmael out of the house. They're bad news. Ishmael is a physical threat to Isaac when he's little.
Did Jacob came up in the womb somehow, attack? How?
He came, his name is, he's holding on to Esav's heel. Yeah. Like my twin daughters are 6 minutes apart. They weren't holding on to each other, but the older one lets the younger one know she's older. 6 minutes ahead of you, you know? Actually, she kept her sister pushed up in her. My wife's pushed up in the corner the whole time of the pregnancy. She says, you're not leaving until I'm getting out of here first. And you wait a couple of minutes, then you can come out, that kind of thing. Okay, but you look at the women in these stories. You see the women see things the men don't see. Why? Because women see things that men don't see, as great as these men are. It's funny, every culture has this idea of women's intuition. Women are naturally on a higher spiritual level than men. I always find it very ironic that a lot of women who are very feminist think that the way to show their connection to Judaism is by doing what guys do. Like, I'm going to wear tzitzit and a kippah. Because a man wears a kippah. You don't realize that it's a lower level. Why does a man wear a kippah? A man has to wear a kippah because he thinks he's God. Because men are big egos with legs. They have to put something in their head to remind them there's something above them. A woman doesn't need to. She knows there's a God. I say, like, a woman wearing a kippah is like a 20-year-old wearing a diaper. They think it's a step up. It's a big step down. You know, think about it. Besides God, who knows you better than anyone else in this world? Your mother. And she still loves you. I have a book about Jews and organized crime. It's called Buddy Was Good to His Mother. It's a fascinating topic. Women see things. Rebecca loves both of her kids, but she sees that Esav has something wrong in his worldview. Jacob's got to be the one who carries on the mantle of leadership to the next generation. She engineers this fascinating story that we're all familiar with. What's the story? She dresses Jacob up in Esau's clothing. What's the background?
Isaac is old and blind. He wants to give his son, Esau, a blessing. Now remember, it's more than just you should be blessed. He's imparting spiritual energy that's going to have implications for the future. And he's also passing on the mantle of leadership to the next generation. So Rebecca, again, it's the woman doing this. She gets in there. You know that joke? If you want to get something, want something said, get a man. Want something done, get a woman. So here she's doing the doing here. She dresses Jacob up in Esau's clothes. So he smells like Esau. Isaac probably smells real well. He doesn't see well. She puts what on him? Goat skin. That's one of the biggest questions I have in the Bible. Like, how hairy was this guy? You ever seen a goat? Every time I get to the store, I think of Planet of the Apes. Anyway, he goes in disguised as his brother. Isaac, who can't see but can hear just fine. Jacob comes in and says, come, father, and eat so you can give me a blessing. And Isaac says, well, you sound like Jacob. And he feels him. He goes, but you feel like Esav? Hakol kol Yaakov hayadayim yade Esav. The voice is the voice of Jacob. The hands are the hands of Esav. Now, simple reading of the story is the simple reading of the story. You sound like one, you feel like the other. But we know that the Torah, as the rabbis say, there's ayin panim v'Torah, the 70 faces to the Torah. The Torah is like an onion. You peel off the layers. The most superficial layers are the simple plot line, and you get deeper and deeper, Kabbalistic, metaphysical. You leave the plot behind and go into all kinds of other stuff. Just peeling off a couple of layers, you see something fascinating. Kol kol Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Jacob. Okay, who does Jacob become? His name is even changed to this. Right. Israel. He's the Jews. He's associated with the voice. And the voice is an amazing thing. Think about the voice. I'm talking right now. Electrical impulses in my brain are sending signals to my vocal cords, which are vibrating and sending sound out of my mouth. Across the room, your ears are picking it up and vibrating and changing those vibrations through the eardrum and the bones into electrical impulses. You're processing it and you're actually understanding what I'm saying. It's an amazing thing. Speech is incredible. Speech is uniquely human. Only humans speak. Animals can communicate. Communication is not speech. Speech is lower level. You guys appreciate? Like, you ever heard whale music? The whales, like, what are they talking about? Life after death. First cause, what's the meaning of it all? What are my kids going to do when they go to college? No, they're talking about they're very intelligent animals, whales, by the way. They're communicating where the kelp is and where the cute female sperm whale is back by Japan. Maybe we'll go back there and go have a dinner, that kind of stuff. Humans, the ability to think abstractly, communicate abstract thought, uniquely human, associated with Jacob. Jacob is the Jews. What do we learn from this? The power of the Jewish people is spirituality and intellect. That's our greatest strength. You know, Golda Meir once said, I'm really angry at God. He made us wander in the desert for 40 years and then brought us to the only place in the Middle East with no oil. I'm not angry at God. We don't need oil. Do you know, by the way, do you know, take oil out of the economic equation of the Middle East and 5.4 million Jews in Israel far outproduce 300 million Arabs in 22 Arab states of the Arab League. All they have is the oil. Our greatest resources up here, like we say in Spanish, the Yiddish cup. That's actually a Yiddish expression for like Jewish brains. That's our strength, spirituality, intellect. We've never been the largest nation, never been close to the strongest nation, but our ability to make progress in this world and change the world and have impact has come from using our intellect. Okay, that's the Jewish people. The hand is the hand of Esav. What's the hand synonymous with? What's it connected with? Right, physical. By the way, human hand is also unique. You ever seen a primate like a chimpanzee's hand? They have a thumb, but it goes this way. The manual dexterity of a human hand is also unique in the world. But that's associated with physical might, what holds the sword. Who does Esav become? I should get the right color for this. Who does he become? Well, Esav becomes... His name is Edom, by the way. One of his names is Edom, which means literally red. Edom, it's also a nation. Edom becomes Rome. Out of Rome, what is the other? What is the actually first monotheistic faith that comes out of Judaism? Christianity. As we'll see, it starts out as an offshoot of Judaism, but basically it's taken over by the Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Church. And of course, Rome ceases to exist as an empire, but it metamorphosizes into largely what is called the West today with a capital W. And this, by the way, is a much more powerful force than Arabs and Islam. Especially, this is the real rivalry in the world, we're told. Ishmael and Isaac, they're half-brothers, okay? These guys, think about it. They're twins. Same, unlike here, when you know the father, Hagar, you know, is the mother, and Abraham is the father of Ishmael. Here, it's the same family. This is a much more intense, much more close rivalry in history. Okay? So out of this relationship comes a huge spiritual force, Christianity, and a very powerful force in history, Western civilization, which has been the dominant civilization in the world. The whole story of history, and I'm not saying this because I'm white European or anything like that. The reality is the whole story of the West's interaction with the East and anywhere else in the world, or the South, or anywhere, has been the West going out and conquering. Right? That conquering, imperialism, industrial, everything comes from the West outwards, for better and for worse. Yeah, had a question?
So Rome, like the Romans, they trace their lineage to?
That's an interesting question. Do the Romans trace their lineage to? I can't find an explicit Roman source that says we're from Aesop. We have a tradition that goes all the way back. Contemporary rabbis living at the time of the Roman Empire say it openly, constantly, that this is, the Romans are Edom. These are the same people. There's a tradition, there was a Roman holiday they talked about. I haven't seen any inside Roman sources for that one. But by the way, if you understand how it works, it fits very consistently into the relationship between Jews and Rome and everything that goes on. And it's a very common theme of the rabbis of the period of time of Roman occupation of Israel, this relationship. It's classic. It's talked about all the time. Understand Esav, understand Rome. Same people. Okay, what happens in our story? Esav comes back. Now, Esav, we know earlier in the narrative, he was the firstborn. Firstborn is a position of double inheritance but unique responsibility. Esav doesn't want the responsibility. Remember, he gives it to his brother. He sells it to his brother for some, like, Heinz baked beans. Chalateni na min adoma domaze. Give me some of that red stuff, you know, and all. You can have my firstborn status. I don't want it. But he definitely wants the blessings that come from being the firstborn. He wants the material benefit. That's his thing. He wants the physical world, dominance of the physical world, which is not what Jacob wants, by the way. Jacob wants the responsibility. He doesn't care so much about the other stuff. So when Esav comes back and finds out that he's been tricked by Jacob, he's mad. And you don't want to get Esav mad. Esav is a dangerous person. Like, you don't want to get Rome upset with you. Remember their motto? Travel to exotic places, meet interesting people, and kill them. You know? So what does he say? As soon as my father Isaac is dead, I'm going to kill my brother. Rebecca finds out about this prophetically, and she tells Jacob, get out of here. Go, flee. Jacob flees back to Turkey, Haran. He goes to live with Rebecca's brother. Excuse me, Lavan. Brother, Uncle Lavan he goes to live with. What does Lavan mean?
White.
White. Never trust anyone named Mr. White. He's the biggest crook in the Bible. Remember the story, if you know the narrative. Jacob falls in love immediately with his cousin, Rachel. But he's tricked into marrying Leah. Everything about Lavan is deception. Okay? And we know that Lavan does his best to keep Jacob under his thumb and poor and under his control. And Jacob manages to beat him in his own game. He ends up, by the way, getting the woman he loves and a lot of extra women out of it. He ends up getting first Leah, and then he gets to marry. 7 more years he works for Rachel. Then he, by the way, takes each of these women, give additional wives to him. Like, what's going on here? You know the punishment for polygamy? There's 2 mothers-in-law. No, I'm just joking. What's going on? Judaism, by the way, in theory allows it. Not anymore. Not in a long time. But why would a woman give another woman to? Most women get really jealous if their husband looks at another woman. Yeah, it's a fact. Well, first of all, but more. Okay, so fine. We'll adopt. You know, like, well, I'm not gonna. You know, we'll give you a teddy bear. So they had some kid. The point is these women are very, as we say, lishma. They understand that they're doing it for the right reasons. They appreciate that they're involved in a very important process of creating an all-star team that's going to make a nation that's going to change the world. They want to have as many players as possible. So they're very much in competition. Their maidservants, Bilhah and Zilpah, the kids that come from them, are sort of like they consider them their own children. And we know from these 4 wives will come. Rachel will have 2 boys. Bilhah will have 2. Zilpah will have 2. And Leah get 6 boys and 1 girl, Dinah. Okay, so you get 12 kids, all 12 boys specifically, all dedicated, that's the frontline squad, all dedicated to the mission. Now, so we've gone through a filtration process. If you look what's happened here, each generation, 1 kid goes off. First it's Ishmael, then it's Esav. By the time you finish filtering it all, you get this pure product at the end. Which we'll see when we get to the next story of Joseph, they weren't so clear that that was the end of the filtration process. That's part of the understanding about why the brothers had it in for Joseph. They figured he was the black sheep of that generation. But look at what else Jacob has to go through. He has to deal with the most deceptive, 2 most deceptive people in the Bible. Esav, hunting with his mouth, and Mr. White the crook. What do we learn from this? This is also a pattern. Incredible pattern, by the way. We Jews have always, Mark Twain said it beautifully. He said, the Jew has made a marvelous fight in this world and has done it with his hands tied behind him. We've always been subject to restrictions and penalties. Our ability to move freely, act economically, has always been restricted. You know, in Frankfurt, Germany, 200 years ago, this is not thousands of years ago, Frankfurt, Germany, 200 years ago, there were 36 special taxes that only Jews had to pay. Can you imagine? A tax to be born, a tax to die, a tax, you know, for marriage, a tax for burial, a tax for wearing a kippah, a tax for Shabbos candles, for kosher meat, a tax for not serving in the German army, which you weren't allowed to serve in anyway, if you wanted to serve in the army and not pay taxes. It was ridiculous. We had to do it with our hands tied, which means we had to learn to be smart. Think, this is exactly in the story here, that Jacob has to deal with the most deceptive person, yet he's able to beat him his own game, because we have the smarts to do it. This is the Jew in history over and over and over again, which is why you look at your great-grandparents, if you're from America or whatever it is, England, South Africa. They came from Poland, you know, probably 100 years ago, whatever, 120 years ago, with nothing but the shirt on their back and a few dollars in their pocket. And within two generations, they're the most successful, highest income earning bracket. It's a combination of Jewish drive and Jewish smarts. Okay? So what happens? God tells Jacob, you know, the only place Jews can achieve their potential, we saw it in those first few sentences, is where? The land of Israel. How long is Jacob separated from Esau? It's over 20 years. You ever heard the expression, time dulls all pain? With everyone but Esau. Okay, Esau has a very long memory. So God tells Jacob, you got to go back to the land of Israel. Okay, you got to be there. Sorry, you got to confront your brother also. You got to, you know, that has to happen that way. He's there waiting for you. So probably Jacob's hoping for the best that his brother's, like, you know, forgotten about the stealing of the blessing. But as he starts to come back to the land of Israel, he hears that Esau is coming out to meet him with 400 men. Not a great sign. Okay, no red carpet. So what does Jacob do? What does he do? He does. He follows a three-pronged strategy, which is extremely important for us to learn from. One, he sends gifts, diplomatic initiative. Okay. Two, he splits his camp, which is what? Prepare for war. Three, he prays. God runs the world. This is such an important lesson we have to always remember. You don't rely on miracles. You got to make the right motions, but you got to remember that God runs the world. I'm sure all of you heard that joke by now. The flood's going to come, let's say New Orleans, you know, the levee's going to break, and they announce on the radio everyone should evacuate their houses because there's a danger of flooding. And this very religious guy is like, God loves me, God's going to save me, a miracle's going to happen, you know. So the town starts to flood. They come by in a four-wheel drive vehicle, and he's like, this house is already getting to flood. And they say, get on the truck. No, God's going to save me. Water goes up to the first floor. He's in the second floor of the house. They come by in a speedboat, get on the boat. No, God's going to save me. You know, he's on the roof of his house about to get washed away. They come by in a helicopter with a ladder. Get on the helicopter. God's going to save me. He drowns. So he gets to heaven. He goes, God, I believed in you. He goes, why didn't you save me? He goes, who do you think set the radio announcement, the four-wheel drive vehicle, the speedboat, and the helicopter? Generally, that's how it works. You don't rely on miracles. So he follows this multi-pronged strategy. Now, by the way, we're talking about the Romans and Edom. This is a specific example. We're told that the rabbis, thousands of years ago, when they would have to interact with the Roman Empire, which are the descendants of Esau, and knowing that the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children, we're told that the rabbis would specifically study the story from the Bible of Jacob's reunification with his brother Esau, knowing that within that story was the key to how to understand the relationship between the Jewish people and the Roman Empire, because the roots are back in this story here. Interesting. The actions of the fathers are assigned to the children. The rabbis took that very seriously. So what is the what happens in the narrative, guys? These brothers meet, and Esau doesn't try and kill Jacob. He doesn't try and kill him, although it's very clear from the commentators that he still hates him. As a matter of fact, Rashi, the great medieval commentator from Troyes in France, 1,000 years ago, who's, by the way, always answering the most obvious questions you should be asking if you know the story a little bit and are thinking, Rashi puts in there, he quotes, he says, Omar Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a great second century Tana, one of the rabbinical leadership of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. He's the author of the Zohar, the basic book of Jewish mysticism, which he wrote when in hiding from the Romans who had a price on his head. So Rashi is quoting Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai from 800 years earlier. He says, Omar Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, Halacha chi biyodua
She'esav sonet Yaakov. It's a law like gravity that Esav hates Jacob. Deeply ingrained. We're being told that within, and the anti-Semitism you see in Europe, which most of us aren't exposed to because we live in places like America or Canada, where it's not acceptable to be openly anti-Semitic. Go to Eastern Europe, and they wear it right out in front of you. It's unbelievable, the hostility you can face there. It's very uncomfortable sometimes. But we say that a lot of that animosity goes all the way back to this even subconscious hatred that is deeply ingrained in Western civilization that comes out of this rivalry that goes all the way back to that story. But he doesn't kill him. He's overwhelmed by the emotions of the moment. What does Esau offer Jacob? He says, come with me. Come with me to Mount Seir. Okay, we're going to go into business together. Yeah.
When Esau sees Jacob for what he has done with his firstborn blessing, that he has a family, wives, and everything. He's like, this is what you got, then you can have it. I don't want it.
Jacob says, I got stuff, but I don't want it. He sends him lots of gifts. He knows Esau wants that stuff. He says, this is not what I want. No, I'm not interested in this. It's yours. You can have it. You can have the physical blessings. I don't want it. That's not my thing. But does it work? Enough that his brother doesn't kill him. But so what does Esau say? Come with me. What is Jacob's answer? He says, Yavona fanai. You go on ahead. Now we know, by the way, that Jacob does not, he's trying to get rid of his brother. The rabbis say, even from that story, you should learn something. You ever stopped at a gas station, a suspicious guy starts questioning where you're going? Tell him you're going much further than you are. He'll wait. He might be a guy who's going to ambush you, and he's going to wait way up the road. Meanwhile, you'll get off and exit somewhere else. He says, you go on ahead. But the point is also that Jacob recognizes, if I live with this guy, forget it. You live in a bad neighborhood, it messes up your kids. How am I going to stay a nice Jewish boy with raise my kids in the right environment? So he says, you go on ahead, I'll catch up later. Now, what's fascinating is everything that these people say sets off wheels turning up there. That they're going to have impact for the future. Now, by the way, can you imagine? Interesting counterfactual historical scenario. We've got two more minutes, guys. What would have been if Jacob and Esau had lived together? Imagine the Roman Empire with a Jewish CEO. It would have been unbelievable. They'd still be making a profit and controlling the world probably and doing real well, and their stock would be through the roof. It doesn't happen. It says, you go on ahead. The Talmud in Avodah Zarah says something fascinating. It says, until that moment when Jacob said to Esau, you go on ahead, I'll catch up later, the children of Esau and the children of Jacob are supposed to walk together as equals. Jacob telling Esau, you go on ahead, is the Jewish people telling Rome, Edom, Western civilization, you go on ahead, progress in terms of technology and everything else in armies and empires. You want that anyway. You conquer the world. It's yours. That's what the West has always been into. As soon as the West becomes, an empire, they start conquering everyone. Anyone and everyone. They start conquering here and there. But in the end, and that's the last thing, the last Rashi, and this that I want to mention, the last thing I'm going to say now, is Rashi says, if Jacob's saying to Esau, you go on ahead, I'll catch up later. And we know that Jacob never goes to live with Esau. When will Jacob catch up to Esau? Sorry? No, he quotes from Ovadiah. Ovadiah is one of the smaller prophets of the Hebrew Bible. All the prophets of the Hebrew Bible, the later prophets, end with predictions about the future, messianic redemption. He quotes Ovadiah. Ovadiah says, "Va'alu Moshim lahar Tzion l'shbote et ha'resa v'hayta Hashem ha'melucha." And a redeemer will go forth from Zion, not the parking lot here, that's Zion, Mount Moriah, same place, misnamed by the Crusaders. A redeemer will go forth from Zion to judge the mountain of Esav, and God will be king. What's that? When's that? Who's the Redeemer who goes forth from Zion to judge the Mount of Esau? Messiah. The ultimate rivalry is between us, the Jewish people, and B'nai Esau. And even though the B'nai Yishmael are right in our face and right down the street here, they'll come back first. Esau will lead the world and be the dominant power, but ultimately the whole world will come. And not that we're going to dominate the world physically like an empire. It's not a Jewish thing to have an empire. But ultimately, even you, Esau, my brother, last but certainly not least, will come back and in the end of days, in the Messianic era, recognize that we, the Jewish people, have a unique position in this world, and you're supposed to learn from us how to build a relationship with God and elevate the world. Okay, so let's now go ahead to the Joseph story. Now, Joseph, it's a fascinating story because here we have so many great patterns in these couple stories. Joseph is a very interesting character. He should have been really the firstborn son in the respect that really Jacob should have married Rachel first, and this was the first son of that relationship. There's a lot of interaction between Joseph and his brothers. He sort of has a position of leadership and dominance in the family.
we see that because of Joseph being the firstborn son of his favorite wife, Rachel, Jacob is showing him favoritism, which seems to have been a mistake because it engenders a certain amount of jealousy. And by the way, it's a big mistake to read this story of Joseph and his brothers as like the ultimate dysfunctional family, intense jealousy story. The characters in the Bible, we have to remember, we're looking at people in the Bible, we're dealing with people on an incredibly high level, okay? But they're not perfect. They make mistakes, but they're on an incredibly high level. The mistakes they're making are not mistakes we make, okay? It's not. This is not like Dallas, you know, General Hospital, you know, Melrose. We're talking about people who are on a very different level from us. And we have to, when we read the stories, we can't just read them simplistically where we learned them when we were 7, 8 years old. We have to look what's really going on here. And one of the deeper understandings of this story is Joseph, look, he's having all these dreams. And they're megalomaniac kind of dreams. Everyone's bowing to him, his father, you know, and his brothers. Now the brothers realize they are the team that's going to change the world. And we have a brother who thinks he's going to do it all by himself. He's endangering not only our family, he's endangering the whole future of humanity. This guy is dangerous. So they're doing it for the right reason. A lot of what they're doing, it's a mistake they made. But from their perspective, they had the right intentions. It wasn't like he has a nice coat and we don't. Let's kill him. God forbid. I mean, I used to fight my little brother. I never contemplated killing him because he's got a toy. Actually, a couple times I may have contemplated killing him. But I never brought it to fruition the way the brothers almost did. Instead of killing him, they sell him to a caravan. Yeah, you had a question? No, he wanted to marry Rachel first. He loved her, but he fell in love with her immediately, wanted to marry her, but he's tricked and he marries Leah. But his favorite wife, his true love, so to speak, is definitely Rachel. He has two children from that relationship. It's Joseph and his youngest Benjamin. Okay, those are the two. They are full brothers. Everyone else are half brothers. So what happens? Instead of killing him, they sell him to like some passing caravan. And he's brought down to Egypt, and he is sold into a servant of Pharaoh by the name of Potiphar. Now, let's stop for a minute and look at Egypt. Egypt is a fascinating. We talked a little bit yesterday about, you know, early great civilizations, Fertile Crescent, the two earliest areas of civilization in this part of the world we have. One is, we talked about yesterday, where Abraham's from, Mesopotamia, the land between the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates. That's a place we said, which is because it's no natural borders, whatever, is going to be conquered. Very open area, a lot of people migrating through, a lot of trade. Egypt is the opposite. It's watered by the greatest river in the world. The Nile, I believe, is the largest river. It's also, I think, the only river that flows backwards, like from south to north. And it's a very unusual place geographically. Think about it. It's in the middle of a desert. If it wasn't for the Nile, there'd just be sand there. In ancient times, 3% of Egypt was inhabitable arable land, which is the teeny part of the land. I've been to Egypt. It's fascinating. You take a train down the Nile, which stops about every 50 feet, so it takes you about 3 days to go, you know, 2 miles. But you stop along the way, and you see, except for Alexandria at the top, where the Nile is a delta, and it's a big piece of land, and it's a floodplain also. Down below, a couple hundred yards on either side of the Nile is green, and everything else is like, you know, nothing. Which means that Egypt is in a very different geographic situation than Mesopotamia. It was virtually impossible to invade Egypt. Egypt is almost never invaded in human history. I mentioned it was invaded by the Hyksos, the Assyrians invaded once, and then finally Alexander the Great. But that's like three times in 3,000 years. It's the most static, continually longest surviving culture in human history, and virtually didn't change, by the way. No great. You think about how little Egypt changed in 3,000 years and how much the modern world has changed in the West, and even a few hundred years, it's mind-boggling how stable that society was. And to a large extent, it was due to the geographic reality of the country. So that's, and it's, again, it goes back early Egyptian civilization. We don't have exact dates for these things, but it's very, very old. We're talking about the beginning, early Bronze Period, 3200-3300 BCE, the earliest Egyptian dynasties, which are going to grow into a great empire at certain periods of time in history. And these are people, as a culture, we realize this is a very sophisticated culture. Sophisticated technologically, the things they built. We're talking about 4,500 years ago. Anyone been to the pyramids? Incredible feats of engineering. Pyramids are just giant tombs. Okay, the Great Pyramid, Cheops. It's close to 500 feet tall, 5 million tons of stone, put together by people who did not have any metal tools. And if you look at the building, it's incredible. Most of the stone, the outside coating, has been stolen and used for other things. But a few places you can see, you can't fit a credit card between these stones. It's unbelievable how they built.
Do they know how they got around to doing all that?
They surmise that they know. There's a lot of things Egyptians could do and the ancients could do that we can't do. Certainly, we could maybe do them with our technology. We have no idea how they did them. They had tremendously sophisticated stone cutting techniques. They had tremendously sophisticated engineering knowledge, enabled them to move large blocks of stone with the knowledge of engineering, which didn't have engines. They had pulleys, they had levers, they had a lot of sweat and blood. Look, the Great Pyramids, Cheops took something like 30 years to build. Why spend so much effort on building a tomb? Because Egypt was also an incredibly, you know, spiritually deep, impure spirituality, but very deep spirituals. Their book is the Book of the Dead. How's that for a real lively book to read? They believed that Pharaoh was a living god. He had absolute power. And that Pharaoh's position in the afterlife, how he did, would affect how the whole all of Egypt would do. So you had to make a really good tomb for him, and you had to give him the right gifts, and you had to make sure that he got into the afterlife correctly. Otherwise, things would go bad for us, which is why it was the entire national project of the Egyptian people to create tombs for the pharaohs when they're going to die. But we're talking about a very sophisticated culture. Mummification, all the things they could do. We have to remember, it's a very important lesson. When you look at the ancient world, we are so arrogant into thinking that we're so much more sophisticated than people in the ancient world. We may have technology they didn't have, but in many ways they are much more sophisticated than we are. There's things they did that we don't know how to do today. I was in the States a few weeks ago, and I happened to be in someone's house, and they had a TV, and I was watching the National Geographic Channel. What a great channel. And they had a guy, really morbid. He was mummifying someone. They got someone to donate a body, and he takes his old Egyptian records, and he goes back to Egypt, and he gets the salts, and they show him cutting the thing, taking the organs out. Ugh. And they did it. And he actually successfully copied a technique which hasn't been done in like 2,000 years. And it works. The only reason why we know how to do it is because he reads the ancient Egyptian documents. But that's incredible stuff.
Did they transpose it into English?
Yeah, you can get all this. You want to try mummifying someone? Yeah, you can read. You can read a lot of stuff. Yeah, they have extraterrestrials. What about them? X-Files? What about extraterrestrials? We don't know. That's out of this class. That's in Cosmic History 101. Okay, so we're dealing with a very sophisticated culture, but we're dealing with a culture that, again, is from the Jewish perspective, as antithetical to Judaism as humanly possible. Totally into idolatry. If you've been to Egypt, you've seen, if you studied about ancient Egypt, you realize. I was in the museum in Cairo years ago. They have a room called Gods. It's this huge room with all these glass cases with little Getchkala idols everywhere. You know, it's the kind of room you can't bend down to tie your shoe in. People think you're worshiping idols in it. Every tomb, you know, they got all these Nut and Ra, and this guy, and you know, all these different gods. They had 2,000 gods in ancient Egypt. And they have hippo heads, and falcon heads, and funky crocodile heads. We're dealing with a civilization that was idolatrous to the extreme. Very religious. And we're not talking about, you know, stupid mumbo jumbo. We're sophisticated people who truly believed in the power of idolatry. When we talk about Moses and miracles, I want to go back to this, because this has to do a lot with our notion of what is sophisticated and what is primitive. There's definitely something to all of this. It's not a bunch of superstitious, primitive people. We're dealing with a very advanced, intellectual, engineering, sophisticated civilization. So to throw little boy Joseph into this environment is bad news. Okay, very bad news. And he, by the way, we're talking about patterns for the future, the actions of the fathers, sign for the, you know, the children. Joseph is the classic case. This whole section that we're getting in now, down to the bottom here, of going down to Egypt and the Exodus story is a real amazing paradigm for what's going to be in Jewish history. And Joseph is one of the first diaspora Jews. I mean, he's living outside the land of Israel. At the time, it was the land of Canaan. He's in an environment that is very hostile. He has no support system. Okay. Now, Egypt, besides being very into idolatry, was a very licentious place. Okay. They were really into immorality. According, at least the Jewish sources say they had a... Now, Joseph has another disadvantage. Besides being separated from his family as a teenager, he's also, like from the Jewish sources, one of the best-looking guys ever. He makes, you know, Brad Pitt, you know, Tom Cruise look very mediocre. It's gorgeous. So he has all of these Egyptian women. He's a teenage guy chasing after him, including Potiphar's wife. It says, as a matter of fact, that Potiphar's wife, she used to invite all of her girlfriends in, and she'd give them all oranges and knives. The Midrash describes the story. And then she called Joseph the servant in, and they would be like, they'd look at him, and they're like, their tongues would hang out, and they'd slice into their hands right through the, you know, right through the fruit. And all of them at once. So this poor guy, he's stuck in this situation. Now Joseph rises. Poor guy. No comment. Joseph rises. He's on a higher level than you and I, that's for sure. Joseph rises from his position as lowly teenage servant to head of Potiphar's household. He's got all the big keychain that opens all the storehouses and everything. This is the classic case of the Jew in diaspora. Comes in, arrives in a bad situation, impoverished, rises to the top. Now Potiphar's wife, is not happy that Joseph refuses to meet her advances. Eventually, at one point, she basically tries to rip his clothing off. He runs away. She screams rape. Potiphar comes home. It must be obvious that he didn't believe her, because otherwise he probably would have had her killed. But he can't allow him to stay in the house, so he gets thrown into prison. So what happens? Joseph arrives at the bottom, head servant, then he crashes. This is the Jew in diaspora. We come into a country, we rise, we're thrown out. We start at the bottom somewhere else. Joseph is now in prison, and he rises very quickly to be the head prisoner. He's running the whole place. He's like the chief capo. Okay, this is again the Jew. Into prison is thrown Pharaoh's wine steward and Pharaoh's baker. Now I'm running through these stories quickly because, again, this is not a Bible class, but there are some really interesting patterns in here we have to look at. Now, they did little things wrong, but, you know, if Pharaoh's a god and if he has a little piece of sand in his bread, it could be off with your head, you know? And they have dreams. Now, Joseph's always interpreting dreams. Dreams are a huge thing for Joseph. And Joseph interprets their dreams, and he tells the baker, he tells the wine steward, Pharaoh is going to reinstate you into your position. He tells the baker, you're going to lose your head. And that's exactly what happens. The baker is executed. The wine steward is reinstated. And as he's leaving prison, Joseph says to the wine steward, maybe you'll put in a good word for me to Pharaoh. And, of course, the wine steward promptly forgets about Joseph altogether for a couple of years. The moral of the story being, great pattern in history, Jews should never count on too much help from non-Jews in human history. It doesn't come too often. So he rots in prison for another 2 years. And then we jump ahead. We're at the end of the book of Exodus. I mean, the end of the book of Genesis, excuse me. Pharaoh has a dream of these seven fat cows coming out of the Nile, and then seven thin cows. And the fat cows eat the thin cows. And then he goes back to sleep again. And he has the dream of these seven sheaves of wheat, fat sheaves of wheat, and then seven thin sheaves of wheat, and the thin ones eat the fat ones. And he's very disturbed. And believe me, if living God on earth, Pharaoh can't sleep, none of Egypt sleeps. So he wakes up all of his magicians and his soothsayers and his, you know, astrologers, and none of them could figure out what the dream is about. And then the wine steward says, I remember there was this Nar Ivri, like this Jewish kid, one of the only times we see the word, you know, Hebrew used in the Bible there. Little Jewish kid in prison with me, and he interprets dreams. Now this, by the way, is the ultimate Jewish success story right now. They schlep Joseph out of prison, probably in the middle of the night. They shower him, they shave him. He stands before Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I had a dream. This is not the Martin Luther King speech. He says, I had a dream. My dream is X. Joseph says, no, that's not your dream. Pharaoh deliberately changed his dream. Joseph tells him what he really dreamed. Pretty cool, huh? And he says, not only is that what you really dreamed, but it means the following. There's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Pharaoh's like, whoa, awesome dream interpreter we got here. What should I do? And Joseph says, you better stockpile all the grain in Egypt. So that when the famine hits, we'll have what to eat. Pharaoh takes off his ring. He says, you thought of it, you do it. He becomes viceroy of Egypt. For all practical purposes, the most powerful man in the whole country in terms of day-to-day functioning of Egypt, of the most powerful empire at the time. How's that for promotion? Prisoner to viceroy. Okay, and he gets, as a wife, Pharaoh gives him a wife, Osnat. Okay, Osnat is the daughter of Potiphar. It's amazing he ends up back in that family again. Before the famine hits, he has two children, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, what's very interesting about Manasseh and Ephraim, we bless our children on Friday nights. You've been to someone's house and they bless their kids? You go to your daughters and you say, God should make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And then you'd expect that we go to our sons and say, God should make you like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses. No, we say, God should make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Yisim ka Elohim ka Ephraim ka Manasseh. Why those two guys? Why them? Of all the people you could think of, they're hardly the greatest characters in Jewish history. So there's two very nice thoughts that go along with these two brothers. One is that Manasseh is older than Ephraim, yet Ephraim is greater than Manasseh, but they're not jealous. Now, however well-intentioned Joseph's brothers are, there's a level of jealousy in there which is incredibly destructive. And we want our children to be like Ephraim and Manasseh, that they love each other regardless of who's up on top and who's greater, and they're not jealous of each other's accomplishments. Number two is these kids grow up as son of the viceroy. They could have been totally assimilated, spoiled Egyptian brats. Yet it's very clear they grow up as completely loyal proto-Jews in an incredibly hostile environment. And this is the first Jewish diaspora we got here. We want our children in the diaspora to have that same internal strength, that love for each other and that ability to survive in what is a very hostile environment. Okay, so that's why we bless them like that.
Even though we do that in Israel, but
it's not. Yeah, because we're still in diaspora. Even if you're in Israel today, we are in diaspora. When the temple, until all the Jews come back and the temples we built and we're all keeping Torah, this is diaspora. Okay, which is why we still pray for Jerusalem to rebuild, even though we're sitting in a nice new building here. Because rebuilt means building a temple and the spiritual rebuilding of the Jewish people. Yeah. Diaspora is the Greek word for scattering. We'll talk about that a lot later. It's a good question, though. Okay, now, let's keep going with the Joseph story. I want to just finish talking about the reunification of he and his brothers, and then we're going to stop there. Now, Joseph, when his brothers sell him, they don't go back to Jacob and say, by the way, Dad, you know, your favorite, you know, son of your favorite wife, we sold him as a slave. No, they take his little beautiful coat, Tonet Pasim, that lovely coat that he had, special with the colors and everything. They rip it up. They put goat's blood on it. They bring it back to Jacob. And Jacob says, oh, my God, like some wild animal. And back then, they used to have lions here and everything in the ancient Near East. You know, some lion ate my son or something like that. And he goes into deep mourning. And by the way, Jacob's a prophet. When you're depressed, you can't have prophecy. No prophecy and Prozac together. Doesn't work. You got to be in a state of joy. Joseph has never been in touch since that time with his family. Why? It's a good question. He could have sent a message, hi, Dad, I'm alive. On some level, Joseph definitely realizes that this is all part of a plan and it has to work its way through the scenario. Everyone's got to bow to me. I had a dream. I know that dream is meant to come true. Okay, I have to wait till that scenario happens. Okay, so he's holding back. So for all these years, they're separated. Meanwhile, the famine hits. The famine hits the whole ancient Near East. Jacob sends almost all the brothers, but he doesn't send Benjamin back because Benjamin is the only surviving son, Joseph's younger brother. He's the only surviving son of his favorite wife. He doesn't want to risk losing him. The brothers go to Egypt. They stand before Joseph. They don't recognize Joseph. Joseph walks like an Egyptian, dressed like an Egyptian, talks like an Egyptian. Of course, they're making the mistake of speaking about him in Hebrew right in front of him. Big mistake, by the way. You should always be careful. Like, never speak Russian in front of people on buses, you know, like in Israel. They all speak Russian. Yeah? So be very careful. He understands everything they're saying. Now, Joseph realizes that we've sort of created a groove in the ground here of hatred amongst us. We have to get rid of that. I have to get my brothers to do tshuva, the Jewish idea of repentance, which is not whip yourself a few times and say a few Hail Marys. Jewish idea of repentance, as Maimonides puts it, is you realize you've done something wrong. You commit not to do it again. You find yourself in the same situation and you don't repeat that mistake. You've changed. Joseph realizes he now has a great chance to put his brothers back in the same situation he was in to see if they've changed. He accuses them of being spies. You don't really have another brother back in Israel. And they start to figure out this is all happening to us because of what we did to Joseph. And now we have to bring our other brother. And if we have to bring our other brother, it's going to kill Dad. If anything happens to Benjamin, Dad's going to die. They should have realized, well, look what they did to Joseph. It almost killed their father. And he makes them go back. They come back. I don't want to go through the whole details. They come back with Benjamin. He sets Benjamin up. He threatens to imprison them and enslave them. And there's this big confrontation between Yehuda, his brother, and Joseph. And they're like going to come to blows almost over. You got to let Benjamin go. Finally, Joseph realizes he can't withhold himself anymore. And he says to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? And this is one of the great pregnant pauses in biblical literature. The brothers are just like, and by the way, the rabbis say that's what we're going to be like when you stand before God. No excuses. You're going to be nothing to say. And then he says what is clearly one of the most significant statements in terms of understanding Jewish history. He says, don't worry. I'm not angry. He says this a couple times. I'm not angry, you guys. This is all part of God's plan. God sent me down ahead of you guys to set up this scenario because it's his will that you come down here and everything has to be into place. One of the greatest sayings of the rabbis, which explains Jewish history, is the idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu makdim l'refua l'maka. God puts the cure before the disease. Remember I talked about this idea of we have a finish line, there's a goal, history is a controlled process, our decisions make a difference, but we're promised we'll get to the end. Therefore, regardless of what path we take, God will always make sure that we have a way out. He will put the pieces into place. Now, as they're happening, we don't see how they fit in. But when it's all over, we see it was done for a reason. Joseph, who's a very intelligent person with tremendous belief and faith in God, realizes this is all part of a divine plan. I have to be down here because this is part of this huge cosmic historical process. That is Jewish history. I always say Jewish history is like a giant jigsaw puzzle, right? 6,000 pieces. Every piece is a year. You ever dump a 6,000-piece jigsaw puzzle on a table? Can you imagine? Like, take up the whole floor here. And it has no picture on the cover to see what it's going to look like at the end? Forget it. You start with the corners, you know, because it's flat on one side. What's with the jigsaw puzzle? We know a puzzle. A big, huge puzzle like that, the first few pieces to get into play is going to take forever. But as you go further and further, a couple things happen. The picture comes together. You see everything fits. There's no extraneous pieces. And the closer you get to the end, the easier it is to put the pieces together. That's human history and certainly Jewish history. Everything fits. There are no accidents. It all comes together. Everything has a purpose. And when it's done, you look back and see. Makes sense. All fits. Joseph sees it. And then, just to end off our story, Joseph sends his, he sends a word back to his father, Jacob. He says, I'm alive. Jacob is restored. His prophecy comes back. He's overjoyed. He thinks his son has been dead for all these years. I mean, think about it emotionally. If you thought, you, God forbid, you lost a kid, and you realize, you know, years later, he's still alive, and you haven't seen him. And they have this dramatic reunion when Joseph comes out, and all of Egypt comes out. It's a big thing, you know, it's a big thing. The viceroy's family has been found. We're going to be reunited. And they're all bowing to him, by the way. This is the fulfillment of the prophecy. You know, Jacob, even his father bows to him, you know, which is an interesting story. And Pharaoh invites the whole family to come live, which is where we are over here. 70 individuals enter Egypt. Okay, that's what the family has become now, which is Jacob, his 12 sons, their wives, their children. This is the proto-Jewish nation, arrives in Egypt. And again, this is a great pattern of Jews arriving in a diaspora country. They are welcomed in. They're given the best real estate in the land of Goshen, which is probably the great historical pattern for Jews being into real estate. They settle. Everything seems to be going great. The Jews prosper. We come to the end of the book of Genesis. I'm going to stop here now, and next week we're going to pick up with Exodus and the beginning of what is the most dramatic sequence of events, certainly in Jewish history.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a free cassette catalog, in the U.S. call toll-free 1-800-VOICES-3. Our email address is voices@aish.edu, or write to us at P.O. Box 14149, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem. This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.